preposterous ass that never read so far to know the cause why music was ordained? Was it not to refresh the mind of man after his studies or his usual pain? Then give me leave to read philosophy, and while I pause, serve in your harmony. In Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, Lucentio knows that music is essential to the regeneration of the mind, but what sort of music and instruments would he have listened to, and how well does it come off in modern performances? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. The shawm, the sackbut, the dulcian, the crumhorn, the string drum. You'd be hard-pressed to find any of them in music written after about 1650. But if you go back before then, you'll find a rich and dazzling variety of instruments and sounds. For a couple of generations now, musicians have been trying to figure out what early music sounded like, and our guest is one of them. He's Bob Wimkin, co-director of the Renaissance band Pifaro, and he also directs the early music ensembles at Temple University's Esther Boyer College of Music and Dance in Philadelphia. He's also recorded on many major record labels. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's good to be here.
Let me put it bluntly. What happened circa 1650 to music? After that date, roughly, we're getting early Baroque. Before that, we call it early music, and there certainly seems to be a big difference in sound either side of roughly that date.
You know, and I think we're still trying to discover just what it was that impelled not only the composers but the instrument makers to go in a whole new direction. There certainly is a continuum of things that are happening, and we can follow the course of composition from Renaissance polyphony into the new style of monody, as we call it, and early opera, and then finally the Baroque concerto and orchestral suite, that sort of thing. But there does seem to be a period in that middle part of the 17th century where something new was afoot, and though we're beginning to date the new Baroque-style instruments a little bit later, maybe more of the 1670s, even 1680s now, still there was a new thing on the scene.
It was a fairly tight musical world, was it not? Europe, including England in those years, the influences seemed to travel pretty quickly.
There certainly was an international language with regional refinements and differences, but certainly the language that most everyone knew and that composers were trained in was that of Renaissance polyphony, and that language from the end of the 15th century was a fairly universal one. You would be writing similarly in England as you would in Italy, as you would in Spain, and with certainly nuances that reflect a local color, but the school was similar. And yes, I think things did travel very quickly.
With any kind of history, including music history, it seems to me if you're trying to put yourself into the mindset and get the attitudes, the sound that was intended, we have a real problem, don't we? Because we are inevitably looking back from 100, 200, 400 years instead of looking forward from what developed
That is precisely the issue, I think. Yes, certainly. We have been in general trying to compare modern and historical instruments. Those who are playing historical instruments have been working for decades to gain a certain amount of recognition and respect for what they're doing in the modern world. And it's happening, I think, now that many modern players, teachers, conservatories are beginning to pay a great deal of attention to the early instruments. But there's a world of difference between a modern player picking up a historical instrument and playing as opposed to someone who, for instance, plays Renaissance music and goes into the Baroque and then emerges into the Baroque from being informed by Renaissance style, for instance, an oboist informed by playing shawm, as opposed to playing a modern oboe. Modern instruments really have nothing to tell us about the performance of Baroque instruments, for instance. And yet that's almost what happens historically if we don't pay a great deal of attention to stylistic elements, all of which grows out of a continuum of composition and practice into the, for instance, Baroque period, then we lose the style, and the style is really what we're after.
Where does it come from then? Obviously, if we're talking early music, how early can you go? I suppose all the way back to about, what, Hildegard of Bingen in the 11th century, but pretty quickly we get into, so far as what we have, later, what, 13th century, 14th century, that would be early for even early music.
That's right. That's right. However, even I think there is more and more interest even in the questions of where the medievalists were informed. So we're beginning to ask more and more questions about Greek music.
Greek music. How can you possibly answer questions about Greek music?
That is a very good question. In a former life, I was a classics scholar and thought about doing my dissertation on Greek music, and my would-be advisor at the time said, don't get involved in that. It's killed many dissertations.
I've seen in all my years with CDs, thousands of CDs, I think I've seen one CD of conjectural ancient Greek music.
Right, right. But asking the questions about where modal theory came from, which so much informed medieval and Renaissance writers and performers, as well as Baroque people, carrying that continuum back, asking the question, for instance, about intonation. What kind of intonation were they playing in the 16th, 17th century? And one has to go all the way back to Pythagoras in 5th century Athens and do the numbers, do the calculations for how he built his scale in order to really fully ground yourself in what follows and where we emerge in the 17th century. So we're looking pretty far back, actually, for criteria for an awareness and understanding.
What would be an example of a piece that just is emerging from medieval to Renaissance?
One of the jobs of the Renaissance wind band was playing in the cathedrals, but not only in, but sometimes on the steps of the cathedral to attract people into the in for the whatever mass hour it might have been.
Come on in. The music's great.
Yeah, come in. The music's great. Listen to this. And they did play. They played motets. We're also told that they could improvise these rather complex polyphonic compositions. But, of course, they began learning that from boyhood. But the piece Adieu Mes Amours by Josquin des Prez, who himself is kind of a pivotal figure between the medieval or very early Renaissance and standard Renaissance style, is a good case in point. He writes this piece utilizing canon, which was a wonderful game composers played in the late medieval period especially, in lower voices. And then the upper voices have a little descant style interplay, which is in an improvisatory style and may very well suggest that this is the kind of thing that was happening in the late medieval period over the slower moving canonic part. And yet it's in four-part writing, which is already getting us ushering us into the 16th century.
Yes, that is kind of having a foot in each world, isn't it? There is a sort of heavy medieval quality, and at the same time, this wonderful play of kind of light and shadow in the higher tones. Now, you mentioned improvisation, Bob. If something was improvised, how can you begin to figure out how it was actually played? It presumably wasn't written down.
Yeah, it's a very good question. We certainly know that pre-printing days, the players did a great deal of playing from either from memory or from their own skill sets.
It's kind of jamming.
Sort of jamming, sort of like jazz players who have this vocabulary of licks behind them that they can draw on. And I think that's what the late medieval, early Renaissance guys were doing as well, because they were trained from boyhood on to do this kind of thing. We know that some of the bands might have numbered six people, and if they're playing a five-part composition, the sixth person might improvise an additional line because he knew the rules of counterpoint and he could simply and it was his practice. It's what he did every day. So we have to do a lot of guessing. We have to do guessing about so many things, which is really the thrill of working in this period. We don't – the sheet music doesn't tell us what to play it on, how to phrase, how – anything. And so we're left up to our imagination and to our scholarship as far as that can take us into the past, into the clues of performance practice. And I would say sometimes we take liberties and it may or may not reflect what happened, but it gives us the sense, I believe, of that sort of thing.
And who's going to contradict you and say, no, we didn't play it that way?
That's true.
Well, but I am reminded of a conversation I had once with Franz Bruggen, the recorderist who, must have been back in the late 50s, early 60s for the Archive label, did a series of recordings of, I guess, early and Renaissance music in particular. And I asked him, somewhat after the fact there, do you ever go back and listen to those old recordings? And he said, he had a pretty dry sense of humor. He said, yes, to laugh at them, because he said they had learned so much about performance style and technique since those early recordings that they had made. So in what performances could you point to where you say, well, this is something that we're playing very differently than we would have played it 10 or 20 years before?
Well, Pifro has had as a part of its signature is the use of bagpipes, and bagpipes were ubiquitous throughout Europe. Every society had their own variety, their own little tweak on the bagpipe
principle.
Came
from Italy, I guess, originally, or do we not know?
We don't know exactly where it came. Probably came out of the Middle East. As so many of those things did, but at a very early period. And the use of bagpipe in the pay records in the 15th century for these loud bands, there was a bagpiper. Not only did they play shawms and sackbuts and all of the official instruments, but they also had bagpipers. How did they use them then? And you can see in the depictions in the iconography a shawm player together with a bagpiper with maybe a couple of other. And yet there is no music that says, play this on bagpipe and shawm. So we've experimented with that. And one of the pieces is this wonderful late 15th century German piece called In Feuer's Hits that comes out of a manuscript that was published in 1480s. And on that, it seemed just perfect for the combination of bagpipe and loud winds.
I'm almost tempted to say, so where's the bagpipe in there? It's not exactly right. Scotland the Brave, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. And bagpipes in the period ran everything from a quiet little instrument that the Germans call the Hummelchen, or the little bumblebee that just has a quiet buzz to it, to this slightly louder conical bored outdoor pipe and every area in between.
Well, it does make a great ensemble instrument. And speaking of ensembles, there's this word that keeps turning up in early music, and that's consort, which has all kinds of fascinating connotations. We'll delve into that a little bit in just a moment. This is University of the Air.
PortalWisconsin.org includes a statewide events calendar, feature stories, news, virtual tours, streaming video and audio, a gallery of Wisconsin artists, course listings, and much more. It's all online at PortalWisconsin.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Bob Wimkin, and early music is our topic for this hour of University of the Air. Early music, we'll say pre maybe 1670 or 80. It looks as if the jury is still out on exactly where early music left off. We mentioned just a minute ago these ensemble performances, and you hear the word consort coming up, particularly with early music, and I can't think of it coming up any later. What's the difference between a consort and any other ensemble from later in music history?
Well, I think that what's most significant about consort practice, and especially the 16th century, as it seems to be the century where this blossomed, has a lot to do with the connection between music and the prevalence of word, of text, and consequently of vocal music. The premier consort was, of course, the soprano, alto, tenor, bass chorus during this period. And almost every instrument was an attempt to emulate every instrument that we might think of as a consort-capable instrument. And makers would consequently produce double reeds in every size, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, so that there would be this homogeneous sound in the production of each vocal line or each voice line. And so much of the music was vocal. They played the vocal repertoire. And if it was untexted, they might even be inclined to think about text insofar as how that determined the phrasing of the untexted music. So it's so much ground in text and that vocal consort that everyone was trying to copy.
Well, there's always been a question still unresolved about what exactly is the difference between speaking and music,
definitely.
Talk and conversation and music. And here you definitely have both going on in an example of consort playing.
You do. So much of Renaissance polyphony is about the conversation among the various voices. It's something that carries us into the Baroque period as well. However, the conversation changes in not so subtle ways, actually. But we're always thinking about that. And throughout the 16th century and the humanist emphasis on text and poetry and the revival of Greek and Roman poetry, and that is model for composition, we have such a preponderance of this kind of textual-inspired playing and textual-inspired composition that the instrument makers and instrumentalists couldn't avoid. You know, they had to be a part of that tradition. One of the soft ensemble, as they were called, they were the loud instruments and the soft instruments. And one of the prominent instruments of the soft ensembles in the 16th century was the recorder, in multiple sizes, from a very tiny little one called the Garklein Flutlein, a very little flute, to the 6-foot contrabass. And here's an example of a 6-part composition, a vocal composition, secular in this case, German piece written by the Swiss composer Ludwig Senfel called Was wird es doch? Thank you.
So a sound that's instrumental and yet very reminiscent of what could have been voices.
Right, and every instrument of the same family covering each of the voice lines. And that wasn't necessarily followed entirely because the loud consort in the Renaissance turned up to be a combination of reeds and brass, which was favored over a combination of four sackbuts. Certainly the sackbut or the early trombone was made in a variety of sizes as well, but some of the sizes proved to be useful and others not. The little soprano sackbut was just too small to be able to be played in tune, so the alto and tenor, or actually the tenor and bass sizes, were the more popular. And they were then allied with the higher shawms. So the reed brass consort was sort of a mixed consort, and yet it was the standard consort. So we've got both full consorts like that recorder concert of like instruments and a kind of mixed consort of reeds and brass in the loud band.
One of the developments out of the Renaissance era was the concerto grosso, which actually contrasted a group of soft with a group of loud instruments.
That's true. It's interesting that in the move into the early orchestra in the 17th century, that it is predominantly the consort principle that's driving it, but the consort becomes a consort of strings. So the basic Baroque orchestra now is a consort of soprano, alto, tenor, and bass strings, to which is added the color of the various wind instruments. And that's a 180-degree turnaround from the Renaissance, when it was the consort of winds that were the principal instrumentalists. And only gradually through the 16th century did the violin, the Renaissance fiddle, come indoors out of the fiddler was an itinerant street musician up until the 16th century. And then we began to expand the string consort. And that then eventually ascends to the point of being the core ensemble of the orchestra.
So what would an early music piece sound like that was a combination of those strings and winds? Were there what, equal, or where the winds still have the larger say?
I think that is most characteristic of this period in the late Renaissance and early Baroque period, that first 50 years. And I'm thinking here especially of the combination in Italy of a choir of violins with a choir of brass. In the north, in Germany and Austria and the Flemish lowlands, there was a much greater use of variety of instruments, so that the reed still had a real presence in the works of, say, Michael Praetorius in the early 17th century. He published this work on all of the instruments that were being played at that day, and the work is full of woodcuts depicting them, even to scale, with little scale drawings to give you an idea of how large they were, and tells us what points to a hole on a wind instrument and say what note that hole played. So we have a lot of
very
good information from that. But there you would find choirs of reeds, choirs of brass, choirs of voices, and choirs of strings all together in this massed sound that is early Baroque to a certain extent, in that it is based more harmonically on the chord progressions that we are becoming more accustomed to in the 17th century than modal theory of the 16th century. And there you get all of the color variety that was possible at the time.
Well, that could compete with a pretty good-sized contemporary orchestra for a sheer output of sound.
That's right, and that's where they were going, especially in the north, and this massed sound of different vocal and instrumental colors and textures, rivaling, as you say, rivaling the orchestral size and sound.
Is it oversimplifying to say that strings tended to predominate in Italy and the south and the winds in the north of Europe?
We may be oversimplifying, but I would agree with that. I think that certainly by the end of the 16th century, the double reeds in Italy begin to recede. Now, that's very different from in Spain, when the sham type of instrument that was played in the Renaissance is still played today in Barcelona in the Catalonian bands and the Cobla bands. It became metal and it got a lot of keys, but it's still a sham. And it's played in outdoor, out in the plazas, and people come out and dance to the Cobla bands, still playing shams. But very different in Italy. In Italy, the strings were the predominating instruments, as well as the brass, the cornetto, that sort of half-breed between woodwind and brass instrument, and the trombones. Whereas in the north, the reeds and all the winds were quite predominant through into the and I think that influenced people like Telemann and Handel and Bach in their use of winds.
We do see even in those later composers what seemed to be traces of these early instruments still. I mean, Haydn wrote pieces for the hurdy-gurdy, which we think of as an early instrument.
That's right, yeah.
And well, it's not all that early. It's more of a Renaissance instrument. But Hummel, who was a contemporary of Beethoven's, wrote a mandolin concerto, mm-hmm. wrote one mandolin concerto for whatever reason. And Vivaldi's kind of an interesting case. I guess we're still figuring out exactly what some of the instrumentation he used was.
Well, we know that he wrote for some of the so-called bassoon concerti for this one particular convent of nuns for that orchestra. And there they were playing not the new Baroque bassoon, but rather the Renaissance dulcian, as they are related. The dulcian is pretty much one piece of wood and the bassoon is jointed, and there are alterations to the bore to help with certain areas of the register. But the range of the pieces that he wrote these bassoon concerti fit on the dulcian and could be played on this earlier Renaissance, early Baroque style instrument rather than the new Baroque bassoon.
So some of those instruments did carry through for a while.
Well, and very interestingly, the same dulcian was called the chorist fagot when it was emerged in the 16th century, in part because it was a very vocal instrument. And in these cathedrals, these large resonant spaces, it was hard to project bass. And so male voices singing down to G's and low F's had a hard time of balancing the trebles. Consequently, they frequently used a bass dulcian player with the choir to help reinforce the bottom voice. And we have evidence that that practice, playing the same Renaissance-style instrument, not a bassoon, all the way into the 1930s in Spain. It's a tradition that continued in the cathedrals into the middle of the – almost the middle of the 20th century.
We'll get some ideas to how early music sounds on modern instruments and how well that works or doesn't when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
The news, the music, the discussions you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio often trigger a need for more information. It's available at 1-800-747-7444. Audience Services, 1-800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Bob Wimkin. We're delving into the world of early music, a world still mysterious in many ways, but it certainly yields some gems of sound and instrumentation. And how well does it translate into a contemporary or a 20th century orchestra? Over the years, Pretorius, we heard some Pretorius a little while ago, played by large-scale symphony orchestras. I'm going to guess that you don't think that works too well.
You know, it's an issue of appropriateness, I think. And I think that's the one lesson that we've been learning over the past few decades, that there are instruments that are appropriate to a period of music. And we sometimes think of evolution, but we don't like to talk in terms of the evolution because the instrument that played, the Baroque oboe that was playing Telemann Oboe Concerti, was appropriate for the music of the time and perfect for it because of very stylistic and cultural, social reasons. And so, yes, to play a Handel Concerto Grosso on modern instruments is not only to leave that appropriateness, but also to alter the whole tonal color of the piece itself.
Well, let's take something that's actually pretty ultra-modern by early music standards, something by Handel, let's say, almost the end of the line if you're talking early music of any kind, and hear that briefly in a performance by the Berlin Philharmonic.
Berlin Philharmonic, Raphael Kubelik. Mm-hmm.
And then we'll, after that, see how that stacks up against what would be considered a more authentic performance, and we'll see which one you like. So was that kind of a nod to the earlier performance style there where we just now heard everything scaled down to just a couple of fiddles?
Perhaps, but it is a very slight nod.
It was short, yes.
Yes, but this is Handel that is informed, as we were saying earlier, by our modern sensibilities and not informed by earlier sensibilities. And so we have long, extensive lines with those heavy bows that the modern string players are playing and trills that seem to last forever on these notes. And we can hear this constant vibrato, which is itself a fairly late addition to the orchestral repertoire, you know, something like 1930s is
really
the earliest that I think the Vienna was the first orchestra to begin to use constant vibrato in its style. So it's a very late interpretation of a piece that we think today sounded very much different.
When you hear the Philharmonia Baroque version there with Nicholas McGagan conducting, it's much more sprightly when you come right down to it.
I think that if we take into mind the whole Baroque period, Baroque architecture, Baroque painting, Baroque dance, we realize that that whole era is about the gesture and the grace and the flowing lines, the asymmetry of the gesture. And the gestures are quick. They're not necessarily long.
Yeah, that becomes
gestures.
Immediately apparent.
Right. That the Nicholas McGeegan's introduction, da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da,
yes.
You know, is about that gesture, about that little statement. And then it, once again, it's back to this conversation among the different voices and this chattering back and forth rather than the weight that the Berlin interprets the piece with.
It's certainly, instead of a wall of sound, you have really more of a fairly intimate dance quality.
And I think that I remember that the Baroque flutist Christopher Krieger has said in a number of occasions in the past that all the Baroque music is in one, and we need to feel that big beat. Well, of course, this is what they inherited from the Renaissance theorists and even medievalists. Tincturus in 1492 says, we govern ourselves by this thing we call the tactus, the big beat, and everything is a subdivision of that big beat, and it should be true of Baroque music as well. And what is most important, as you mentioned, is dance.
You know, also, though, I think I hear a lot more bass in the Berlin Philharmonic. And what would be the difference there? Is it, again, just the sort of the size of the instruments?
Well, I'm sure that Berlin was using a substantial 16-foot component, and we don't often use 16-foot to that extent in the performance of Baroque music, although we are discovering that and by 16-foot, of course, we mean playing the bass line an octave lower so that you expand the tessitura of the whole ensemble. We're discovering that that was a part of late Renaissance practice as well, even though up to this point we haven't really explored that territory, those of us performing Renaissance music.
Well, here's an oxymoron for you. Is there contemporary early music?
Contemporary early music.
People still writing in that style?
Well, interesting that you should mention that. I think it goes in hand with something that we've begun to think ourselves, that we talk about historical performance and historically informed performance, and they're cumbersome terms, and yet they are there to help us identify what we're doing as in comparison with, in contrast with modern performers. And we're hoping that one of these days we won't need to talk about that sort of thing. And one of the directions that we're going in this regard is treating these reproductions of Renaissance instruments as modern instruments, as instruments capable of expressing a modern idiom as well as any other. And Pifero then has commissioned this work based on the practice of the wind bands in the Renaissance and their in the cathedrals and their connection with the various services of the church here, and commissioned a Vesper service for chorus and Renaissance winds, and we're still calling them Renaissance winds because that's what we are. And yet it is a thoroughly contemporary idiom, drawing on, for its inspiration, on the Reformed tradition, Luther and the Lutheran tradition in the late 16th and early 17th century, and on a lot of the great hymn tunes that arrive to us and are perfectly contemporary and that we hear them regularly. And
that included Bach and Praetorius and that same Lutheran tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what does it sound like?
Well, I'm quite thrilled with it, actually. It gives hints of the early era that inspired it, and yet is also informed by the three or four centuries of development beyond, bringing us to the present. The two pieces that you'll hear are the first two in the Vesper service. The first is an introit to the opening chant that is a portion of all of these services. And the second takes us right in directly into a hymn, one of the more popular ones, Wie schön leuchtet der Morgenstern, that comes out of Luther's own hand. Praetorius and Bach both produce versions of this. And these two then open the Vespers and lead us into what would subsequently become a series of psalms and readings, and then the Magnificat at the end, and then the final Deo Gratias, the final event of the Vesper service.
So using an early music ensemble, but this is a piece, the ink is still wet.
It certainly is. We'll be recording this next week, actually, for commercial recording, and this is from a live performance in January.
Thank you.
those were the first two sections of this longer work, full Vespers. It's entitled simply Vespers. And the composer is Kyle Smith, who lives and works in Philadelphia and who, interestingly, has a daughter who studied with me at Temple and is the latest Pifero edition. So,
Pifero is one of those great early music ensembles and early music as well as ultramodern music in this case, but as written for instruments that might have been used in the Renaissance, and it puts a whole new cast on the sound of the instruments and, of course, the sound of the contemporary music. Our guest this hour has been Bob Wiemken, who is a member of Pifero and a man of many parts, as one should be if he is a Renaissance man. Thanks for joining me this hour.
Thank you, Norman. It's been a pleasure to be here.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, how much can you get away with when you're saying something ill of someone? Does it matter if what you say is true? We'll look at some celebrated libel cases next Sunday afternoon at 4, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.